Joe Biden descends towards political zero, and New York City bodega worker stands his ground, and the left lies and lies some more about abortion. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexander Zan de Sanctis, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are NetChoice, Babbel, and ExpressVPN. More about all of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. And before I do anything else, want to talk to you a little bit about NetChoice and its cause. Our country is being rocked by soaring inflation, lackluster leadership, and chaos on the world stage. Americans need their legislatures to focus on the issues that matter and ease the economic pain we are all feeling, but far too many politicians in Washington are focusing on their careers and pursuing pet projects, refusing to address our real problems. Senators like Amy Klobuchar are pushing a big government takeover of America's tech industry through progressive regulations that would worsen inflation and make important digital services like Amazon Prime harder to use and more expensive. Conservatives must block progressive pet projects that will raise prices and undermine our world standing. These lawmakers are our last hope of keeping American innovation number one. Join us in telling Congress to stop raising prices and reject progressive tech regulations like S-2992. Learn more about this fight and send a letter to your representatives at netchoice.org/2992. This message brought to you by NetChoice. Again, check it out at netchoice.org/2992. So Jim Garrity, we recording here Tuesday morning, as is our wont in the first episode of the week. A shocking poll we had yesterday, New York Times, Siena. We were talking just Friday whether Biden would continue to descend from an incredibly low 38% approval rating and the Real Clear average. And lo and behold, you get this New York Times poll, 33% approval for Joe Biden. Two-thirds of independents disapprove of him. Three-quarters of registered voters see the U.S. moving in the wrong direction. Only 13% think we're on the right track. And you have a bunch of Democrats who don't want Joe Biden to run again. What do you make of it?
So throughout 2019 and 2020, a whole bunch of us looked at Joe Biden like, wow, that guy got old. You know, we'd last seen him in 2016 as he was, you know, riding off into the sunset after two terms as vice president. But we were told not to, you know, oh, no, you're being ridiculous. He has a stutter. How dare you, you know, make fun of him and all that kind of stuff. Julian Castro accused Biden of having memory lapses during one of the debates, and no one ever saw him again. It was as if he'd been abducted by aliens. You can see pictures of Julian Castro on the side of a milk carton.
It was, as you pointed out the other day, it was a crude way to bring it up.
Yeah, it was a terrible way of doing it, but also, like, he said the unspeakable. He you know, it was a faux pas. Your grandpa's getting up there in years and he can't remember the way he used to, but it's rude to point it out to his face, right? And so for about the better part of 2 years, Democrats insisted, no, Joe Biden is fine. Yeah, he's a little older than most presidents. And as I, you know, John Ellis accurately put it, there is a ways you could, like, gently allude to it. He's lost a little speed off his fastball or something like that. Or he's not as quick on his feet as he used to be. And arguably, he was never quick on his feet. But, you know, week by week, month by month, I think most notably around the Afghanistan debacle, like he didn't show his face for 4 days. When he did, he only read remarks, didn't take questions. When he did take questions, it was that awful one with Stephanopoulos. And that was the one where I wrote, you know, something's wrong with the president. Because when the president's fine, he's out in front of the cameras all the time. And you keep getting these comments from his aides insisting, no, he's as sharp as he ever was. He's great. He's fine. Just a few weeks ago, Karine Jean-Pierre said that she has a hard time keeping up with Biden's energy level. Horse pucky. She's in her 40s, what, early 50s maybe? And he's, you know, going to be 80 after the election? It was always implausible. And now it's just gotten too evident. The New York Times, right before this poll, we had written this big story about not just the worries of Democrats, not just the observation that Biden's schedule is not that of a normal president. As many of us have pointed out for a long time, he goes home to Delaware just about every weekend. Doesn't do a lot on Friday afternoons. Doesn't do a lot on Monday mornings. really doesn't do anything in the evenings very much. He does roughly one public event and maybe one photo op per day around the middle of the day. I strongly suspect Biden only has a few good hours in him every day. And I think that's, you know, like that's caught up with him, that he just, you know, you can only do so much. The most valuable resource of any White House is the time and energy of the president. And they've got less than usual. Also, I don't think he's got the best, you know, staff around him. So this mess, this poll right there on the front page of the New York Times, first of all, a whole bunch of stories that suddenly acknowledged it was okay to question Biden's age and energy level and whether it was such a good idea for him to run for another term. But this one is basically telling Biden, you can't do this. You can't. You're just not up to it anymore. We can't keep pretending that everything's fine. You're an old, old man, and you weren't doing such a great job. The only thing you've gotten right on your watch has been COVID-19 going away. And unemployment's low. But other than that, inflation, the border, crime, trying to get your agenda through Congress, everything has fallen apart for the Democrats. And they're trying to desperately say to him, please don't do this again. We can't prop you up again. We can't hide it any longer. Now, it's an interesting question is, does he, or perhaps more importantly, does Jill concur with that assessment?
So, Zan, the lid, no pun intended, sort of came off the discussion of Biden's age a couple weeks ago. But this big New York Times piece by Peter Baker does take it to another level. And for me, the most memorable detail is that White House aides worry about the president of the United States tripping on a wire because his walk has become such a shuffle. And I remember when my mom was fading, you can't literally be next to her every step, but every step she took, every little, you know, when she had to go up a step or there was just a little something to negotiate, you always held your breath and paid special attention. And it's just astonishing that they're not quite at this point with Biden, but the White House is at some similar point with the president of the United States. And as Jim says, they watch the endurance of his foreign travel. This piece opens with an anecdote about how they were going to do what would make sense otherwise and tack on this Middle East trip that Biden is about to embark on or has embarked on with this European trip and do it all in 10 days. But they're like, this is crazy. We can't do this. We got to bring him home and rest him up first. They obviously keep the weekends free. They keep the nights free. And they're all very cognizant of how old he is. And again, it's not just Castro. People who brought this up, Byron York, our former colleague and my friend, was talking about this a lot, writing about this a lot in 2020. And everyone just acted like he was a hater to point out that this is going to be the oldest president ever. And it already showed serious signs of decline.
Yeah, I think it's very clear that something is not right with him. It's been clear since before he became president. The most recent example was him falling off that bike and the way he looked trying to get up. I remember a couple months ago, I think it was a couple months ago now, there's that video of him, you know, there was a Secret Service agent trying to gesture him into the door of the White House, and Biden just drifted right past him along the yard to some, you know, unknown spot and then had to circle back around to look for the door. Like, he just doesn't look well. And that doesn't mean there's something super abnormal wrong with him mentally. It could very well just be that he's an old guy, and he is an old guy. And he seems older than most people his age. It's not, you know, you could be in your 70s and perfectly quick and well, and he just isn't. And it's really starting to show. I think that it was fair to think that this was going to be a problem, even from what we saw during the campaign. I remember right before COVID, I was covering him in person, and he just sounded like an old guy. He didn't have much emotion to him. It was really the only thing he could communicate was anger. Like, his voice would just suddenly get really loud and angry, and then he would kind of drop back into this boring mumble. He's just an old guy. And I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, but at some point it's going to come out exactly how many people knew how bad it was and how, you know, how unfortunate it was going to be for him to be president in this condition. And a lot of people just covered it up and wouldn't talk about it. And I think that the fact that people are talking about it now, and people who you wouldn't expect to be talking about it now, or that these, you know, comments are coming out of the White House, tells you how bad it is.
So I know it's weird as hell. I kind of like the Biden stage whisper in weird and inappropriate moments. I find it quite amusing. But Charlie, you share Jim's interpretation that this coverage is a sign that Democrats in the media are ready to dump the guy.
I don't like his stage whisper because I've never been into horror movies. Yes, I think that the news that majorities, perhaps super majorities within the Democratic Party, don't want him to be renominated, has given the press permission to start the drum roll. If you go back a year, you'll find mainstream pieces. I wrote about one yesterday, Jill Lawrence in USA Today from last summer, in which any criticism of Joe Biden on the basis of age is regarded as dastardly. And more important, hollow. Casual ageism, a desperate attack, unsubstantiated. And now the Times, twice in 3 days, has thrown around every euphemism you can think of for being out of it. Why? Because the Democratic Party is coming to realize that Joe Biden is a liability and that there is going to be no comeback kid moment. I don't think in every case it is as cynical as journalists thinking consciously or agreeing among themselves that they can now take on Biden. I do think that there exist all sorts of unspoken or implicit or intuited permission structures in American politics. And this is one of them. If you read that Democrats don't want Biden again, and that young Democrats, the group that progressive-leaning people really care about, want him so little that only 6% of them would choose him again, well, then it's fine to start saying he's really old. And it's fine to start printing interviewees' quotes that describe Joe Biden as a zombie. It's fine to start using every euphemism under the sun. But I think that this is what's happened in the media. I think within the Democratic Party, there is a secondary incentive to pushing Biden out, or at least to casting him as being out of it. And that is that someone who is out of it cannot necessarily be blamed for the consequences of the ideology the Democratic Party exhibits. If Biden were 39 and he had made all of the decisions that he's made since January 20th of last year, Republicans could say cleanly, this is what happens when you elect Democrats. This is what happens when you allow progressives to run the federal government. But if Biden's old, he's not really with it, if sadly we've learned that his age was a problem, well, maybe a more vigorous progressive like Gavin Newsom will make it work. Maybe progressivism hasn't been tried. And I think the combination of these two realizations has led Democrats to start talking openly about nixing Biden from the White House.
So, Jim, there is another thing in the mix here. We didn't get a chance to pick it up a week or two ago when it first broke and discuss it on the pod, but you had this voicemail that was revealed from Joe Biden to Hunter after, was it a New York Times story? It was a story about Hunter's business dealings. And you have Joe saying, oh, you know, I just read it online. It seems fine. You're in the clear. I love you, buddy. Just reaching out. Give me a call when you have a chance. So this isn't Joe, you know, on a voice recording saying, yeah, let's transfer, you know, the $500,000 that you just got from this shady Chinese tycoon into this other account, but it implies a level of engagement and knowledge, engagement with and knowledge of Hunter's business dealings that Biden has been engaged in great exertions to try to deny.
Rich, I didn't get to hear to the entire voicemail. Did it begin with him saying, hey kid, it's me, Pedo Peter? For those who think I'm just making things up, allegedly that is the nickname Hunter Biden has for his father.
Well, look, we all flatter our parents.
Yeah.
What the hell? Imagine discovering that. Imagine if my dad found out that I had him in my phone as, you know, Murderer Michael or something.
Charlie, what are you saying? Let me do the loud voice and then the whisper. We all have names for our dads. Pops, the old man, Pedo Peter. It's totally normal. So one of the things I just want to, there's two observations, but the first is Joe Biden was sold to us as this lovable, wacky neighbor during the Obama years. The Onion portrayed him as the Trans Am driving, shirtless, you know, nutty guy who's, you know, generally harmless and lovable next door. He always goes to eat ice cream. You know, everybody loves ice cream, you know, this utterly harmless thing. And one of the things that was part of that image was he's such a family man. God, you know, he's suffered in the past. He's been through these tragedies. Nobody loves their family the way Joe Biden does. And I'm kind of left wondering, Hunter Biden is this really unpleasant fly in the ointment. It is this really kind of glaring point that raises, is Joe Biden this exceptional father? Is he, you know, I don't doubt that he loves his kids, but Hunter Biden is really screwed up. Back before the election, I laid out every story Hunter Biden had ever appeared on. It was just endless influence peddling. It was endless. You know, he was a lobbyist, but he never lobbied his father. Wink, wink. Everything he had done in his career was in one form or another trading on his father's name. And it was, you know, also involved his uncle and all kinds of other folks in the Biden family who decided they were going to cash in on Joe being in the Senate and then being in the vice presidency. He's always had shady business partners. He's always had these issues. And then you throw the drug abuse on top of it. And then you throw the sex clubs and the strippers and all that stuff. And then you throw the child out of wedlock. And then you throw in the affair, cooking up with his brother's widow. Like it's just a Dagwood sandwich of scandals piled atop of scandals to the point where, like, I think, you know, you don't have to be Dr. Freud to say this is an angry young man who desperately wants his father's attention and desperately wants to either bring down his father or is raging against his. There's something very complicated going on there, right? And you look at this, and there's kind of this question, like, why does Joe Biden get to have this kindly, genial, friendly old man neighbor image when clearly he's got a son who's so extraordinarily troubled, and apparently nothing Joe Biden has ever done has been able to mitigate this. I mean, Hunter Biden is still a maniac. And of course, now he's selling art for, you know, huge sums to unknown donors. And it's totally not foreign governments. It's totally not foreign people who want favors from his dad and all that kind of stuff. It's, you know, extraordinarily.
So Jim, if I can interrupt you. So I think it's unfair to, and I'm not sure you're doing this, but to attribute how screwed up Hunter Biden is to Joe, just because.
Yeah, I think it's fair. Know, I think it's fair.
I don't think so. But I think the thing that the criticism that would be fair is Joe at some point saying, look, you don't have anything to do with shady foreign business partners. You don't travel to a country that, you know, my job as vice president is to establish a relationship with the leaders there. Nothing that even has the slightest hint and gets 100 miles within impropriety and clearly of impropriety. And clearly that conversation never happened.
Rich Lowry, Rowie, my son is the smartest man I know, as he insisted on the show. There's not a single thing my son has ever done wrong. Those are the kinds of defenses he would. Joe Biden is in deep, deep denial about what Hunter Biden is doing. And in that sense, he's enabling. And in that sense, I think he's at least partially responsible for how bad things are for Hunter Biden.
So Zan, how do you look at, how do you interpret this voicemail? And do you think Hunter is a potential time bomb under Biden's presidency? Not that they're pretty soon there might not be much left to blow up anyway, but
yeah, I really don't know. I mean, this stuff has been trickling out now since before the election even, and no one has seemed to care. I think it the picture gets steadily worse and worse the more that we learn. But so far, I think everybody has kind of separated it from Biden, you know, President Biden. And in some cases, I think rightly so. He's not. I agree with Jim that he's an enabler, certainly. And I don't think he's a good man. And so I don't think it's surprising that he's raised a bad son. But I don't think he's directly to blame for a lot of it. And so shouldn't get the direct blame for a lot of what's gone on. But it doesn't help matters. I think the optics of it certainly just make the whole scene look worse. And as you put it, yeah, the presidency's already failing. So I don't think it helps, but it might not hurt much.
Next question to you, Charlie Cook. Still in all, given the alternatives, which aren't great, and begin with Kamala Harris, Joe Biden would be the strongest Democratic candidate in 2024, yes or no?
Yes, and that tells you something about the Democrats' bench.
Jim Garrity.
Up until recently, I would have said yes, but when your approval rating is at a third and dropping like a stone, I'm going to say no. I think that, you know, fresh start with Gavin Newsom might look very appealing right about now.
Fresh start with Gavin Newsom sounds like a new CNN show.
Zan.
I mean, I think on paper, he looks about as good as he did in 2020, which is why he became the nominee. But I think people have seen a lot more, and he's not just a candidate on paper anymore. And so I think he's actually a pretty big liability. So no.
Yeah, I'm with, sorry, Charlie, we're all abandoning you. I'm a no. I would have been, I've been a yes on versions of this question all along. I just think it's so pathetic. It's the whole thing is melting down, and his state is not going to get any better. So, you know, maybe even Kamala Harris would be a better alternative. And if not her, there has to be someone who is, doesn't have the millstone of all the presidential failures around their neck and is not 80 years old or more. So with that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor of this episode, Babbel. For all of your summer travels, whether you're going abroad or staying domestic and want to immerse yourself in the culture, now is the perfect time to start Babbel. Babbel is the language learning app that sold more than 10 million subscriptions thanks to Babbel's addictively fun and easy bite-sized language lessons. There's still time to learn a new language before you reach your destination. With Babbel, you only need 10 minutes to complete a lesson, so you can start having real-life conversations in a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Other language learning apps use AI for lessons plans, but Babbel's lessons were created by over 150 language experts. Their teaching method has been scientifically proven to be effective. With Babbel, you can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you to improve your pronunciation and accent. There's so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and even live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Start your new language learning journey today with Babbel. Right now, save up to 60% off your subscription when you go to babbel.com/editors. That's babbel.com/editors for up to 60% off your subscription, babbel.com/editors. Please check it out, Babbel, language for life. So, Charlie, there's been a big controversy in New York City, a Harlem bodega. There's a clerk, 61 years old. He has a interaction with a woman who wants to buy chips. Her food stamp card is not working or is out of money or whatever it is. So she can't purchase these chips. He maybe rips them out of her 10-year-old's hand in an impolite way or whatever, but it's an unpleasant interaction for whatever reason. She goes, finds her boyfriend, tells her boyfriend. The boyfriend comes back to her to the bodega, goes behind the counter. The clerk, 61 years old, has a white beard. We've all known such a gentleman if you've been in such New York establishments, pushes him against the wall, pushes him down into a chair, is standing over him menacingly. A tussle ensues. The bodega worker produces a knife, stabs the man several times. He ends up dying in a hospital. The girlfriend stabs the bodega worker. At the end of this confrontation, the bodega worker is arrested, taken to Rikers Island. Initially, I believe, unbelievably, given how these things usually work in New York City, the bail was going to be $500,000 on a murder charge. It gets bid down to $5,000 and he's released. But there's a video of this. It's gone viral. There's been a lot of discussion of it. What do you make of it?
I think it was self-defense. Or at least I think it was enough self-defense under New York law to qualify. And certainly that if this is taken to trial, no jury will convict. One reason we have a jury system, of course, is as a check against overzealous prosecutors. And as I said the words overzealous prosecutors, I had to stifle a laugh because we're talking here about New York City.
Yeah, Alvin Bryant.
Which has historically done a fairly good job of countering crime, but has abandoned that pose. This is what Ross Douthat would call, I assume, decadence. where we have major cities that are not willing to enforce the law against criminals, but seem to be treating a self-defense case as if it were a murder. Suddenly, New York City has found its enthusiasm for zealous prosecution. I don't think that the cases track perfectly, but this reminds me in some respects of the Bernie Goetz case from the 1980s, which of course I don't remember personally, but have read about.
Goetz was less justified though.
He was.
That was going to be my point, so save it for me, Charlie.
Yeah, he, right, well, I'm old
enough to remember Bernie Goetz.
When I lived in Union Square in New York City in my old bachelor days, I lived in the same neighborhood as Bernie Goetz, and you'd occasionally see him wandering around. He was a big pot smoker, so he'd kind of wander into one of the local parks and light up.
Well, I bring up the comparison not because I think they're identical and not because I necessarily think that Goetz was justified, but because when you have the combination of rising crime and a feeling of helplessness,
yeah,
and what the citizenry believes to be overzealous prosecution, you have a recipe for disaster come trial. And I think that's what we're going to see here.
Yeah,
I think that as crime increases in New York, and as the number of New Yorkers whose primary political interest is the reduction of crime increases, and as they become more motivated, that this sort of prosecution will turn the residents of the city against their government and towards, and I'm not drawing a direct comparison either, towards Giuliani-type figures.
Yeah, so Zan, obviously, you know, this is a tragedy. Don't want anyone to be killed, to lose their life. But if you're the bodega clerk, what are you supposed to do? Just wait to get the crap beaten out of you, or worse? I mean, you have no idea. This guy's come back behind the counter. He's invaded your space. He's physically assaulted you. He is younger and stronger. So it just, as Charlie points out, just seems a classic case of self-defense.
Yeah, I think his response was more than understandable, given what was happening. And I know from the report I read, it sounded like the girlfriend or the woman who was trying to buy the chips at first was, you know, saying to the bodega worker, "I'm going to bring my boyfriend here to, you know," with a bunch of profanities, but essentially to attack you, right? Mm-hmm. She was pledging that was his purpose in coming there. You know, he wasn't coming down to settle the dispute via conversation. That's not what was going on. So he was there expressly to intimidate this guy and possibly harm him into just, I guess, handing over the chips. I'm not sure what the end game here was. He clearly didn't do anything wrong. Maybe he was rude in the interaction. I don't know. It's not super clear. But the alternative here is that he was just supposed to give away free things to people whose, you know, payment isn't working, which is not fair and not right. And then this guy standing over him and intimidating him into doing so. And I don't think there's any way really in that context to fight him, given the size differential, the age differential, and get him to go away, right? There was no kind of way to scare him off. Presumably any conflict that didn't end with him being at least severely injured was gonna end with the bodega worker dead. And so I think what happened was understandable, as sad as it is. I think it was self-defense.
Yeah, Jim, this guy, I haven't seen any stories written about his personal story, Jose Alba, the 61-year-old bodega worker. But again, as I mentioned earlier, we all know this type, and he's not there for trouble. You know, he didn't choose to work in a tough neighborhood, you know, because he had a lot of alternatives. This is the way for him to make an honest living. And, you know, there are cases where these guys are shot and killed or robbed at gunpoint. And, you know, your hearts go out to any victim of any violent crime, but especially to these guys. They just want to make a honest living. They're working long hours and a thankless job. And they deserve a lot of our sympathy.
Indeed, Rich. One of the points that I make when I'm arguing gun control with people is very often you'll encounter the you know, someone who lives in a safe neighborhood and who doesn't feel any need to carry a gun or have a gun in their house. And they say, "Well, if I don't need one, why would anyone else?" And I say, "Okay, but, you know, do you work the midnight shift at 7-Eleven? Do you have to walk home through a bad neighborhood? Do you, you know, are you a young woman who has to go into a dimly lit parking garage. You know, that's why the right to self-defense is so important. If you feel safe, great. And no one's going to make you carry a gun if you don't want to. But the Second Amendment, the right to self-defense is for people who feel threatened. Now, Charlie said a lot of what I wanted to say on this issue, but as someone who is old enough to remember the intense controversy around Bernie Goetz shooting up four guys on the subway back in 1984, I grew up in New Jersey, pretty much we got the New York papers and New York television stations. So that was a huge deal. And you had all kinds of comparisons to, Death Wish, all kinds of other vigilante movies and stuff. But it was a reflection of people feeling desperate, people feeling angry that they felt so threatened every time they left their homes and walked the streets or got on the subways or something like that. Now, I think Peggy Noonan had a very good point in her column this past weekend where she pointed out the crime wave of the 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s pre-Giuliani. There was a certain logic to it, and people felt like they could take certain precautions, right? You don't go into Central Park after dark. Mm-hmm. You only stay on the
radio.
Yeah, you don't go onto the subway unless it's on rush hour. You try to stay where there are crowds and stuff like that. When you hear about whether it's a mass shooting like Uvalde or at the Highland Park 4th of July parade, or some random disturbed person pushing onto people onto subway tracks, people recognize that a lot of violent criminals today are disturbed. They don't have good wiring upstairs. They are, there's no logic to what they're doing. And so you can't anticipate where the threat is going to come. So you can't take those steps to minimize your chances to be a victim. So, this is a tough choice. I kind of roll my eyes and say, oh, for sure. Now the Manhattan DA wants to prosecute somebody. New York City's full of crime, but they can't, it's only the bodega owner they can come after. But you're going to have cases of violent vigilantism when a crime wave gets bad and stays bad. And to avoid these types of situations, you don't want to be in these, if you want to have these cases where someone did something that ended somebody's life and clearly was a bloody, violent matter, but at the same time, they felt desperate enough that they had to do this to protect themselves. Well, then you don't want to be in those situations. Bring down the crime rate, which you can only do through better policing.
Yeah, hear, hear. Charlie Cook, next question to you. The bodega clerk, Jose Alba, will be charged with the crime. Yes or no?
No.
Zan?
I don't think so, no.
Jim?
Well, I was leaning towards, yeah, because, Manhattan DA, stupid liberals, they don't learn from experience. But you guys are closer to the situation than I am. So there seems to be that skepticism.
Deference to your colleagues, Jim. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, so collegial. Just going along to get along, Jim. I too think the answer is no. There's no way. There is no way they're getting a guilty charge on this guy on anything they would pursue. And I'm not sure what the recall rules are in New York if they have recall. But if they do, and Alvin Bragg went through with this, he would get at least a recall would be on the ballot. The level of outrage would just be enormous. So I'll make it, I'm with you, Jim. I'll make it unanimous. The answer is no. With that, let's go to Charlie to hear more about our third sponsor, ExpressVPN.
Indeed, which I use on pretty much all my devices all the time because I use those devices all the time. I am extremely online, perhaps not in the political sense, but definitely in the digital sense. And online, I do banking and I send text messages and I buy stuff and my phone is connected to my car and I just don't want to be spied on while I'm doing that. Unfortunately, a lot of the internet wants to spy on me, including my cell carrier. In fact, Verizon has admitted that it is spying on me and you and everyone. They say that that's because if they spy on you, then they can better understand your interests. But I actually don't want them to better understand my interests. I want them to provide cell service and nothing else. And what Verizon really wants, what they really mean by better understand my interests, is they want to sell my activity to advertisers. They want to know the sites I visited, what I've been up to, and so on. And the more they get on me, then the larger their paycheck becomes, which is a bit of a problem because I already pay them for cell service, which is why I use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that prevents my phone carrier and my home ISP as well from being able to see the sites I visit and to sell off that information to third parties. And all it takes to protect myself is one tap of a button, and all of my network data is encrypted and rerouted in a tunnel through ExpressVPN secure servers for ultimate privacy. It doesn't just shield my web browsing. ExpressVPN protects all of my network data so that I can stay private even when using my favorite apps. And it doesn't matter what phone I have. I have an iPhone, but it works on iPhone, Android, tablets, and computers as well. Even an Apple TV, if you set it up right. ExpressVPN works on all of those devices, and one subscription can be used on up to 5 devices at the same time. So I don't just have it set up on mine. I have it set up on my wife's as well. When your phone carrier tracks you, that is a gross invasion of privacy. So you can either keep letting them cash in on you, or you can visit expressvpn.com/editors, and you can get the same VPN that I use. Take back your online privacy today and use our link to get 3 months extra free. That's express, E-X-P-R-E-S-S, VPN.com/editors.
Thank you very much, Charlie. ExpressVPN, check it out. So, Zan, we have learned a lot since the Supreme Court overturned Roe and the Dobbs case. And one thing that we've learned that we were not aware of before, no one told us this the last half a century, is that Roe was all about protecting the ability of women to get care for ectopic pregnancies. Were you aware of this?
Yeah, so this has been the primary argument, strangely, from abortion supporters in the past 2 weeks. It's actually not that much of a surprise, I think, to people who've been following the abortion debate, in the sense that people who support abortion, Democratic politicians in particular, but abortion rights activists as well, don't actually like to defend their position, which is abortion on demand for any reason throughout all 9 months of pregnancy funded by the U.S. taxpayer. That's their position. And in the wake of Roe, I actually have not seen a single article, maybe they're out there, or a single politician or anybody say, I think abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy is great and every state should be compelled to have that as their policy. No one wants to talk about that. And so instead, the claim, and which is a lie, has been that pro-life laws that are now being put in place in various states are going to prevent women from getting necessary health care, by which they mean, in some cases, care for a miscarriage or, as you point out, care for an ectopic pregnancy. So for listeners who don't,
it
means if the embryo implants somewhere outside the uterus, so most typically in the fallopian tube, and this is a place where it's inhospitable to life, right? A baby can't grow outside the uterus, and so that baby is going to die anyway, and it can put a woman's life in jeopardy as well if it's left to continue developing there, where there's no space for it. And so treatment for that is not actually an abortion, right? An elective abortion is a woman who doesn't want to be pregnant anymore going and, you know, either taking a chemical abortion drug or having a surgical procedure to have a living, healthy baby, you know, in some cases maybe has a bad prenatal diagnosis, but have a baby directly killed and removed from her, right? That's an elective abortion. That is not what happens when you're treated for an ectopic pregnancy. Now, the baby does have to be removed, but the intention there is not to kill a baby. It's to, you know, save the woman's life or to alleviate this health problem for, given that the baby's going to die anyway. So the conflation here is coming from people who know better, who know that this is not an abortion, and frankly, who should know that there's no pro-life law in the country that prevents this type of procedure from being done.
So, Charlie, we've talked a lot about this podcast. We were talking about it before Dobbs came down, that it would have a political impact initially and then fade, and the issues that are sort of top of mind, cost of living type issues would raise the top again. So we've had polling evidence for the correctness of our prediction on this. There's a Harris poll, I think a week or so ago, 5% of people say abortion is their top issue. The breakdown I saw there is 1% of Republicans said it and 9% of Democrats said it. Then we had this New York Times Siena poll that we were discussing a little earlier. 5%, again, focused on abortion. And the breakdown I saw of that one, 1% of men, 1% of men, 9% of women.
I think this has demonstrated that Roe v. Wade was not as important to people as certainly the Democrats, and I'd say an awful lot of Republicans, believed it to be. We had a similar conversation on this podcast, I believe, before the decision came down, and we discussed whether or not it would be a political bombshell, and I suggested that it wouldn't because almost all of the energy would be absorbed at the state level, and that seems to be what has happened. The distinction between Republicans and Democrats is clear. In other polls, Republicans have expressed a preference for abortion to be decided by the states, not by the federal government, whichever branch that may be. And Democrats have expressed a desire for a national rule, whether it's via Roe or Congress. So you're going to see more upset among Democrats, but clearly not enough. 5% rate this as their top issue. That's not going to make waves. And if abortion is your top issue, you probably already had strong views politically. If abortion is your top issue, you're probably not crossing the aisle to vote for a Republican because inflation is high. If abortion is your top issue, you're probably not an independent. There's also the fact, and this has been borne out in separate polling, that Americans who say they favor Roe also favor all sorts of restrictions on abortion that Roe, Doe, and Casey had rendered impossible. And I think once those incongruities are filtered through the political process at the state level, the overturning of Roe, Doe, Casey, and the rest becomes something of a wash. So, you know, a few weeks now after Dobbs was decided and 6 weeks after Dobbs was leaked, it seems clear that this has not been the seismic event that was anticipated. And it certainly seems clear that unless the National Republican Party picks an extraordinarily ham-fisted or unpopular position on abortion and then runs with it, this is not going to save Joe Biden. And in fact, if Joe Biden isn't careful, it may end up hurting him because most of the anger that we have seen has been directed at Biden and his party, which can diminish enthusiasm come the midterms.
So, Jim, we talked on the last app when you weren't on about this chorus that Joe Biden is not, quote unquote, rising to the moment. And it's not clear exactly what this means. It basically means, as far as I can tell, he's just not emoting enough and not saying outrageous and extreme enough things about the court and pro-lifers, et cetera. But he actually has. I mean, you look at the things he said, he said plenty of outrageously stupid things. It just none of it punches through, in part for the reasons we were talking about earlier. I mean, he's just not a compelling and vigorous political figure anymore. He did give a speech, I guess it was Friday, outlining some entirely symbolic matters, ways to increase access or knowledge of how to get abortion. And then most of the other things they're talking about that, you know, providing abortion clinics on federal land or packing the court, they're either completely unworthy goals that would blight Biden's reputation forevermore if you're actually going to do them, illegal or dubiously legal, and or politically impossible, and very often all three.
Rich, you haven't even talked about the possibility of building federally funded abortion clinics in America's national parks. Easily accessible and blending in wonderfully with the land. So I think what we're seeing here is one kind of the popular misconception, or I might even say ignorance of the issue, for the sheer number of Democratic progressive activists who at least initially believed the Supreme Court overturning Roe versus Wade meant abortion was banned. No, it does not. It means it's kicked back to the states. I think that, you know, we've talked a bit on this podcast in the past about how folks on the left, liberals, progressives, are used to having big institutions doing what they want, whether it's the media, whether it's Hollywood, whether it's academia. So when an institution like the Supreme Court says, no, you can't get your way, it really comes as a shock to them. It is like getting hit in the face with like a wet halibut or something like that. They are just like, what? Why? That can't be. And they're kind of in just a state of shock. And, you know, there was this comments from Governor Hochul up in New York that sounded like she wanted to appeal this decision. No, the Supreme Court says final. And when the issue gets kicked back to states, well, then it means the issue is kicked back to the states. There's not a heck of a lot that President Biden can do about this. Why are you looking to Biden to fix this? Look to the governors and state legislatures. But liberals and a whole bunch of folks on the left are so addled and are so focused on the federal government as the source of all solutions that they can't even, how could we get these other states to change their things? We need the federal government. We need Biden to do something. And then finally, I do think this is a little bit of Biden getting hoist on, if not his own petard, then on the petard of the left in general. If you treat a Supreme Court decision overturning Roe versus Wade as an emotional DEFCON 1, it is their, pick your metaphor, Death Star, Sauron, Thanos getting the Infinity Stones, you know, whatever disaster, whatever worst possible thing you can imagine, that's it. Then they expect the response to it to be equivalent, to be on that same level of emotional intensity. And out comes the nearly 80-year-old mushmouth. Well, we're looking at a whole bunch of different options to ensure that women have access. You know, like, no wonder people are disappointed by this. But at the same time, the President of the United States has very limited tools when the Supreme Court hands down a decision that takes the decision away from the federal government. And this is kind of this, you know, it's almost a chicken and egg sort of thing. Why isn't the federal government doing it anymore? Because the Supreme Court has said it's not the federal government's business anymore. And now it's up to the states.
Dan, exit question to you. A couple of weeks after Dobbs came down here, who is winning the battle for public persuasion? The pro-aborts, pro-lifers, none of the above? It's kind of a draw.
I would say it's closest to a draw, but I think it probably leans a bit towards the pro-life side, not because everybody suddenly thinks that abortion should be impermissible from the moment of conception, but because I think the left's promise and the pro-abortion movement's promise was that everybody was going to be outraged and up in arms and rioting because Americans support Roe. And in fact, that hasn't been the case at all. Democrats have barely gotten a bump in polls, if they did at all. The moment has passed. No one really cares, because I think most people, whether pro-life or not, is fine with a status quo of, having a national abortion debate, not, or a state level abortion debate, not controlled by the Supreme Court.
Charlie?
I agree with Zan. And I would add that substantively, and this will now play out in the states, the issue having been returned to the legislative process, over time, bit by bit, very, very slowly, the pro-life side is winning this case.
Jim Gehrig.
Yeah, the polling numbers you pointed to make it really tough to say that the pro-choice side is winning or that this has been this grand galvanizing issue that they were looking for. I would note, though, that we are one aspiring assassin away from looking at this story very differently.
So I think it's a draw. Most people support Roe, but clearly they don't know what Roe is. I think over time, it's going to tilt more in the pro-life direction. There was a poll the other day that showed a super majority in favor of, I think, did you see this, Zan? I think in favor of some form of restriction after 15 weeks. And obviously that would have been completely forbidden by Roe. So people don't get that what their position is on abortion was banned and made impossible to affect by Roe. But at the moment, I think it's been a draw. Let me really quickly pause, do a plug for NR Plus, digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. You sign up for NR Plus, you get beyond our metered paywall. You sign up for NR Plus and you log onto the website when you're on the homepage, ads disappear. It's just like magic, folks. 90% of the ads go away, especially the obnoxious ads that might be distracting you when you're trying to read some of our compelling content. You can also avail yourself of all sorts of options to dig deeper into the National Review community. You can comment on articles and blog posts. You can be part of our private Facebook group where there's an amazing amazingly robust conversation going at any given moment, and you can be invited to exclusive events and conversations with our writers, editors, and conservative newsmakers. I had an NR Plus call that was really terrific last week with Joshua Katz, the great classicist, former professor at Princeton, who was canceled. We wrote a lot about his case, but a lot of wisdom, and it was really fascinating to hear from him firsthand. So that's sort of opportunity you have all the time, and it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. We have great first-time deals running at any given moment, and also very importantly, signing up for NR Plus is perhaps, unless you're become a big donor, which we need and welcome as well, but otherwise is the best way to support our very valuable journalism. So if you already signed up, thank you. If you're not, please go and do it today. So bonus couple exit questions here at the end. Jim Garrity, bombshell news regarding the Elon Musk takeover of Twitter, or what seemed as though it was going to be the Elon Musk takeover of Twitter. That seems it's not going to be the Elon Musk takeover of Twitter. He's backing out of the deal, and there's going to be a big, messy court case about this. Rach, your level of disappointment if Elon Musk is indeed not going to become the owner of Twitter, from 0, meh, you don't really care, to 10, an intergalactic level of disappointment.
I'll put it at about a 6. I think Elon Musk had some healthy attitudes towards free speech that he intended to bring to the platform. But when this came down, I remember writing, like, you know, you look at Elon Musk's statements about China, a couple of the things he's done in his past, this guy was not the savior of the conservative movement or anything like that. And man, did some people hate me for saying that. And now I feel a little bit vindicated that Elon Musk was not going to come along and, you know, make your life 100% better.
Zan, 0 to 10.
Yeah, I'd say maybe a 5 or 6. I kind of did think there were odds that a few things would get better on social media, but I kind of think, or on Twitter rather, but I think social media is kind of a wash at best. I don't think it's really that helpful. I think we spend too much time on it. Not good for most of us. And so maybe this will drive more people off Twitter. I don't know. I'm just mainly disappointed that we all spent so much time wondering what it would bring when he apparently wasn't serious all along.
Drive them off Twitter and right into the waiting arms of Truth Social, right?
Exactly.
Are you on Truth Social yet?
No, right. Certainly not.
Charlie Cook, 0 to 10.
Yeah, I think I'm with Jim. I think it's a 6. I thought that if he bought Twitter might have a fighting chance of reforming itself. Now I don't. I'm not sure that's that important in the grand scheme of things, but I would have liked to see Twitter run by other people and other people who had spoken about the importance of free expression.
So I am a 6. I wish we were on video because I could show in my little notes here how I marked down a 6 before asking this question. Because I'm not like you, Jim. I just don't pick up other people's answers and just go along with the crowd. I'm independently thinking through these really important exit questions. But it would have been a good thing. It would have had more of an ethic of free speech, which is important. He would have slapped down, you know, woke employees. We talked about that a little bit when it seemed like this deal was going to be on, and that would have sent a very useful message to other heads of such companies that it was okay to do that. But in the scheme of things, it's not an enormous deal. And as we were discussing a little bit before we started to record, there was a Megan McArdle, you know, the wonderful libertarian columnist over the Washington Post column, when this whole thing started, that it makes no sense. It makes no business sense for Elon Musk to buy Twitter. I don't know much about business, but her column seemed to make a lot of sense to me and appears to be getting borne out here. So we had a few answers that were a segue, Jim, to the second extra special bonus exit question related to this topic. If Twitter were to be vaporized and just go away right now, rate your level of disappointment. 0, you wouldn't care, or you actually think it's a good thing. 10, you couldn't live without it.
Probably about a 4. There are some folks I've met through Twitter. There are some friends. It's, you know, a lot of fun on Sundays when the football games are going on and stuff. There's also a lot of nastiness. I've also had people telling me they're going to put me in the ovens. You know, all kinds of nasty stuff like that, that I will not, would not miss. So I'd rather have it in my life than not have it in my life, but I prefer a better Twitter than the one we've got.
Zan, I think you're going to be lower than a six.
Yeah, I think almost a zero. Yeah, I'd say zero for me. I would actually be happy if it went away. I certainly would miss, you know, the things Jim cites. There are good things about it. I've gotten good things from it, but if it just went away, it would become a wash, right? It'd be a net zero. No one else would be benefiting from it. It would just be, we'd be back where we started before it. And I think it's so toxic. I think it's bad for our politics. It's bad for our culture. Lies and total falsehoods take off on Twitter all the time. I think it just really distorts everything. And it's a huge time waster in a way that's not really good for anybody who uses it.
That's a pretty compelling case. Charlie, where are you?
I think I broadly agree with Alexandra because, of course, the problem with Twitter is it's a collective action problem. If you leave Twitter but no one else does, then you're diminishing your influence within the small, incestuous little world it represents, and also depriving yourself of a ticker that can be useful in telling you what's going on, especially when a major event is underway or it's NFL Sunday. But of course, if it went away for everyone, then that wouldn't matter.
All right. So after mocking Jim repeatedly for changing his answer, I had written down a six. That's why I said a six after Jim had actually said a four. I guess I'm around where Jim is. I've been convinced I was too high at a six. I do think it's useful. I use it as a news resource. I use it for incredible threads that give you some really deep analysis of issues by people you never would have heard of otherwise, kind of instantly at your fingertip. But it has all the downsides that Zan describes. It is, you know, weirdly addictive. I'll find myself occasionally when I make the mistake of looking at Twitter, you know, at 11 at night when I shouldn't be, of just not really being that interested, but just not being able to stop scrolling. And I'm not going to tweet anything myself. I'm not going to learn anything that compelling. It's just a total waste of time. And if it's also deranged our politics. I mean, there are things politicians say and do that they wouldn't in the absence of Twitter. That's a major downside. But there are things just like Charlie, the Yankee game, second game against the Red Sox in this weekend, four game series they had in Boston, where it was a blowout for the Yankees, and Jackie Bradley Jr., the Red Sox position player, was pitching. I saw a tweet from John Boy, this Yankee tweeter. Jackie Bradley Jr. just got Joey Gallo to fly out weekly to right field. And that's sticking with me. That was like a really, it said a lot about Joey Gallo. And I just wouldn't, you know, probably wouldn't have, no one would have said that. I wouldn't have come across it unless it were for Twitter. So it does have its uses, but major downsides. And if it went away, there'd be some other means of getting kind of instant commentary and analysis that might be, who knows, it might be better.
And, you know, I take your point about the in-depth threads written by interesting people, but I've actually been working on a replacement for in-depth threads written by interesting people that convey a lot of information. It's called a magazine.
Yeah, but Charlie, there is something, you know, there are people that aren't known by the editors of Foreign Affairs yet, you know, or
no, I agree.
Or they're not good at writing 5,000 word articles. You know, we've had this experience, you know, you're editor of NRO and, you know, I might see someone who wrote a good thread on Twitter. Charlie, this guy is brilliant. You know, let's get him in our pixels. And we'd assign something and the person would write a 600 word article. It's terrible, you know, because they only could tweet.
And look, I feel bad when I criticize Twitter too harshly because I benefited from it hugely. You know, people find out who you are. You can spread your pieces. People direct message you. I mean, the problem, of course, is twofold. I mean, people can access you from anywhere in the world, which is really bad if they want to tell you that they're going to kill your children, but really great if they want to fly you out to speak somewhere. So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, well, I may have mentioned this example to you guys before. I was on vacation when the Russian invasion of Ukraine started, and I just tweeted, and I thought about it for about 2 minutes. I actually kind of crafted this tweet a little bit. I'm glad I did that. You know, I wasn't sure that Putin would have done this when Trump was president. And, you know, I had all the appropriate caveats on this thing. And I think there are like four columns written about that tweet, you know, whereas I can, like I wrote a magazine article a couple of months ago about nuclear weapons, and I spent weeks on this thing. It was like 2,500 words. I learned a lot doing it. And yeah, I barely heard anything about it. So, you know, this tweet that took 2 minutes had more impact than this long article. I don't know whether that's a good or bad thing, but anyway, so let's move on and hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, because you are more patriotic and more public spirited than the average bear, Sunday night, you're walking around Washington, D.C., taking in the majesty of our nation capital's monuments.
Well, as great as you make that sound, Rich, actually, we just had a friend in town who used to work on Capitol Hill and decided to go walk by her old office. And it was, you know, the weather was perfect. It was one of those rare nights in Washington, D.C. area in the summer where humidity is not a wet microwave mop hitting you in the face. And, you know, you're walking around, you see the monuments, you see all the Smithsonian museums. You're like, God, Washington, D.C. can be a really nice place. It does kind of, you know, rekindle that idealism. And, you know, remember back when we had institutions, kids, God, that was fantastic. When we actually had, you know, we've had respect and we, you know, yeah, you know, the idea of like jumping into the tidal pool with a stripper was considered a serious congressional scandal, not, you know, leading an insurrection or something like that. So, you know, we all come to Washington with a certain amount of idealism and maybe a little bit of stars in our eyes and the sense that, you know, we're going to change the world. And walking around those monuments and museums kind of reminds you of why people come to Washington, because they want to change the world. Not everybody comes here to make a quick buck. There's more money in New York and Hollywood and places like that. People come here because they care about something. They may be morons, but they care about something. And that's something to be said for the people who end up living in the Washington area.
So, Zan, you had a surprise. Someone threw a surprise book party for you.
Yes, they did. Our good friends here collaborated and conspired, I would say, with my husband to plan a surprise party. I've actually never had a surprise party before, probably because I hate surprises and I don't like when people are staring at me expecting things. So it's especially bad to be surprised with a party for you and about you, but they managed to mostly pull it off. I did, through a series of unfortunate events, find out that there was going to be something happening other than just kind of a regular game night at my friend's house, but didn't know who was going to be there or anything else. So it was a great time. I appreciated the gesture a lot.
And Charlie Cook, you have had a water heater issue.
And I'm still in the midst of it. Whenever I read about people from about 1380 or so, I think, oh my God, didn't you just spend all your time wanting a hot shower? And I now am spending all my time wanting a hot shower because our water heater went and they came and installed a new one. But there's an issue with it, or at least the way it was set up with the recirculation pump. And I'm still desperate for hot water. It really does remind you how spoiled you are that you just turn on the tap and hot water comes out. You turn on the shower and hot water comes out.
No doubt.
And when it's not there, you remember all these remarkable people who keep this system going. And, you just take it for granted. Well, I've taken it for granted in this house for 5 years, and currently, I think it's about to be fixed for good. Currently, I am without it. So I am deeply grateful for hot water, and I can't wait to have it back in my life.
Yeah, so a hot shower might be the most simple, gratifying thing in life. The ratio there is probably hard to match. So we hope you get it fixed soon, Charlie. So I took my brother to the amusement park outside Richmond, Virginia this past weekend. It's in Doswell, Virginia, King's Dominion, his 46th trip to King's Dominion. And it wouldn't have happened if there hadn't been a favor from Zan that I'm very grateful for. I'm not going to describe in detail what this favor was because it's highly embarrassing to me, but Zan helped make this 46th trip happen. So thank you very much, Zan. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
I'm going to go with the excellent work of Dominique Pino. Dominic is just brilliant on all kinds of economic issues. But just you may have noticed this past weekend, people started seeing these just jaw-dropping images out of Sri Lanka, which I know because that's where they filmed Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. But beyond that, most Americans couldn't tell you a heck of a lot about Sri Lanka. maybe they heard that they were trying to eliminate artificial fertilizer, and that was one of the many steps that led them to the disastrous state that they're in. Dominic has been watching Sri Lanka, has been watching the domino effect on their economy, and had this brilliant analysis that was the centerpiece of Monday's Morning Jolt. So just Dominic is on fire, and hope he keeps it up.
Dan, what's your pick?
My pick is a long corner post today, I think, from Yuval Levin. It is a called The New Puritans, and it's in part a review of Noah Rothman's new book, but in part just Yuval's thoughts on the topic. And he's always worth reading and always worth having as an editor's pick.
Charlie Cook, what's your pick?
My pick's by Dan McLaughlin, responding to Jonathan Chait, who seems to be on a jihad against Ron DeSantis. He starts his post, "I regret to inform you that Jonathan Chait is at it again," which really should be the intro to any response to Jonathan Chait. But I think Dan hits all of the relevant points. And I can only hope that if our progressive friends believe that Donald Trump is unique, which I agree he is, that they cut this out.
So my pick is Jim Garrity's Morning Jolt this morning, and its item on the Jill Biden breakfast taco comment. Jim, I'm not sure what the process is for you making editors aware of what topic you're writing on, but I can only imagine that there might have been stiff competition. Who gets breakfast tacos? Who gets the breakfast taco topic? And if there was such a competition, you won it and did a fantastic job about one of the more ridiculous comments in our politics the last couple of years. And there's a lot of competition for that. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes it sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, Jim. Thanks to NetChoice, Babbel, and ExpressVPN. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.